Behind the three transplants, but they didn't want anything to do with the pups. Wouldn't go near them. The Alpha Pure is responsible for the feeding, protection, training, and socialization of its members. It was the alpha male, which is rare, that finally came around. I witnessed it firsthand. We just finished feeding the pups. They were still on formula at that point, and Cujo came and nuzzled one of the pups with his head. From that day forward, they've been like a family. Did you say Cujo? One of Herb's stupid names. Herb named the five adults. I got to name the pups. She paused. Want to hear their names? Do I ever. Well, there's Cujo. He's the big one, the lead wolf in the chase. He's big by even wolf standards, somewhere around 165 pounds. I looked at Cujo. He was watching the others eat. I didn't like being terrified by something that I outweighed by 20 pounds. But then again, I wasn't too hip on spiders either. It was slowly dawning on me that I was sort of a pussy. She continued. The alpha female is J-Lo. She's the big white one on the right. The three transplants are the two gray ones, Quagmire and Carmen Electra, and the black one off to the side, Cartman. She rolled her eyes and said, I don't know where he gets these names. I couldn't wait to meet this Herb character. Cartman was 30 yards from the others, a large chunk of deer draping from his snarling snout. He was perfect black against the perfect white. He trained his eyes on me. Riley laughed. He doesn't seem to like you. No, he doesn't. He was the one wolf that never really meshed. Like the weird uncle that shows up to Easter brunch with his friend Jake. More like the weird neighbor who kills his family. She added, there used to be another wolf. Cartman killed him the first week. Double gulp. I looked at the rather small pups trying to eat the meat, biting at the air, and said, what are the pups' names? Ross, Chandler, Joey, Monica, Phoebe, and Rachel. I wondered if she was a huge Friends fan or if this was a weird coincidence. She gave a little giggle and said, yup, Friends. Matter solved. So I watched Cujo, J-Lo, Cartman, Quagmire, Carmen Electra, Ross, Joey, Chandler, Monica, Phoebe, and Rachel devour Bambi. After about 10 minutes, the pups started playing. They would rub their heads together, and Riley explained they were nuzzling, an important show of affection. At one point, two of the pups made their way in our direction. Riley whispered, the one on the right is Monica. The one on the left is Phoebe. Where's Phoebe's guitar? I don't think she heard me, or she decided to act like she didn't hear me. I'm guessing the latter. The wolves came right up to us. Could have just been a pair of Labradors. Dark blue-black eyes against their fluffy gray fur. Jet-black noses. Truly gorgeous animals. They both had thin collars around their necks. I assumed these were the tracking devices. Riley reached out her hand and scratched Monica behind the ears. Phoebe waited patiently for me to do the same. She bobbed her head from side to side and lifted her ears. She sensed my hesitation and took a couple more steps in my direction, burying her head in my lap. Riley said, somebody likes you. I gently scratched the wolf behind the ears, Phoebe wrestling her head from side to side in obvious enjoyment. Then in a flash, both pups took off back to the pack. I looked at Riley and said, they seem pretty tame. The pups are usually pretty tame for the first year. As they get older, they slowly lose it, but you never know. She took off her glove and showed me her right hand. She had 7 small scars on the fleshy skin between her thumb and pointer finger. She turned her hand over and revealed similar scars on her palm. The wolf has an incredible bite. Their jaws can exert a pressure of more than 400 pounds per square inch. Ross did this to me 3 weeks ago. I was petting him, and then he just chomped down on my hand. Wouldn't let go. 47 stitches. She paused. The second you stop respecting them as wild and vicious animals is usually 1 second too late. Touché. A hollow, throaty bellow snapped my attention back to the wolves. One of the darker wolves had its head snapped back and was howling at the heavens. I think it was Quagmire. Within seconds, all the wolves had their heads reared back and were doing the same. The pup's noise was higher, something between a howl and a yelp, a halp. The cumulative noise was a deep thunderstorm rolling through the mountains. I looked at Riley and said, I thought they only howled when there was a full moon. Did Underworld 2 teach us nothing? They howl for lots of different reasons. Basically, it's to show fellowship to one another and strength to others. I thought that's what chugging beer was for. She thought this was incredibly funny. I noticed movement to my left and turned. Just at the edge of the tree line was a man on cross-country skis. He was dressed from head to toe in white, with one of those white masks covering his face, so only his eyes and mouth were visible. I cocked my head at him, and Riley said, "That's Professor Coble."
"He just follows them around on his skis?"
"Pretty much. If we weren't here, he would probably be eating with them."
"He'd eat raw deer?"
"I told you it was a little different." "I don't know if I would classify a guy who thinks he is a wolf as different. I'd file that under office fucking rocker."
We watched the wolves for another couple minutes. Then Riley started up the snowmobile and we headed back the way we'd come.
I watched the professor at the edge of the trees. He held his gaze on us, much like the wolves had earlier. Halfway into the trip, Riley stopped the sled and asked if I'd like to drive. I scooted up and she slid in behind me. I hit the switch and said, "Hold on tight," I added, "and not to the handholds." She wrapped her arms around me and dug her head into my back. 10 minutes later, I parked the snowmobile where we found it and turned off the ignition. We were about to hop off when I turned and asked, "What are you doing tomorrow?"
"I've got to do a quick round in the morning, but that's about it."
"Why?"
"My sister got me tickets to the Seahawks playoff game on Sunday. I wasn't going to use them, but since you're such a diehard fan and all..."
Actually, I'd been planning on taking Harold, but when I'd asked him if he was a Seahawks fan, he told me that, aside from all the pooping, he supposed they were okay. Anyhow, Riley pursed her lips and said, "Are you asking me out on a date?"
"It would appear that way.
I'd love to go to the game with you." And then she kissed me on the cheek.
Chapter 32. A soft creaking noise jarred me awake and I opened my right eye. The bathroom door was ajar and a steamy fog slowly dissipated into the bedroom. Riley was standing in the doorway, a lime green towel wrapped around her. She had another towel and was drying her hair with it. Needless to say, at this point, I decided to open my left eye. She noticed me eyeing her and said, "Hey, sleepyhead." I smacked my lips a couple times.
"What time is it?"
"I don't know, a little before 8.
A.M.?"
She nodded.
"Can I ask you a question?"
"Of course." I smacked my lips a couple more times before asking, "Are you by chance a morning person?" I'd heard these people existed, but had never actually seen one in the flesh. She nodded again. 10 demerits. She continued drying her hair. I continued to stare at her. She asked, "Did you have a nice sleep?" I raised an eyebrow. Sleep would denote having one's eyes closed and resting.
"I guess there wasn't much of that last night."
No, there wasn't. I closed my eyes and said, "Can you put some clothes on so I can go back to sleep?"
"Maybe I don't want you to go back to sleep.
Maybe I want to have my way with you." I pulled up the sheets and looked down. Paddington was in a sex-induced coma. I said, "I don't know if that's going to be possible." She sighed and continued drying her hair. As I stared at her, a barrage of thoughts raced through my head. How they got there and why, I have no idea. Did I regret sleeping with her? I didn't think so. Of course, if I ended up asking my local pharmacist some rather peculiar questions the following week, then I might. But it went deeper than that. It was like having eggnog before Thanksgiving. It's always there on the shelf, and it always tastes good, but you know it will taste that much better if you wait until Thanksgiving. Then again, I hadn't gotten a whiff of eggnog this year. No, I was fishing dead women out of Puget Sound, so maybe this, Riley, was my eggnog. If you want to dig deeper, and I did, it all came back to Alex. But I wasn't thinking about Alex, I was thinking about someone else. But I was starting to give myself a migraine, and there was a very attractive woman standing half-naked in my bedroom. I lifted up the sheets and whispered, "Psst, psst, wake up." He rolled over but said nothing. Lazy dick. Riley finished drying her hair, then walked up to the edge of the bed. She slowly unraveled the towel and let it fall to the floor. She had small, firm breasts, a perfectly toned stomach, and a thin strip of chestnut-brown pubic hair. She raised her eyebrows. I pulled up the sheets and Paddington winked at me, which is always a good sign. An hour later, I was walking Riley downstairs. She was wearing the same jeans and sweater she'd worn to the game. I was wearing a plaid comforter, toga style. My plan was to walk Riley to the front door, then proceed to the couch, where I would sleep for the better portion of the day. That is, until the doorbell rang. I would have preferred if it had been the mailman.
or one of those annoying kids selling holiday wrapping paper. I wouldn't have minded if it had been one of my nosy neighbors dressed up as Brian Gumbel, or Ethan with a sawed-off shotgun, or an Arab holding a can of anthrax, or a 10-year-old kid holding a blood test, or James Patterson holding his latest novel. It wasn't. Erica was wearing dress slacks and a black sweater. She smiled and said, "Do you even own clothes?"
I think she was referring to the fact that two of the three times I'd opened the door, I had been clad in linens.
I gave a goofy smile and said, "I'm waiting for Cole's spring clearance." She laughed and said, "Can I come in for a minute?" I mentally pulled out a grenade and stared at it. I pulled the pin with my teeth. I put the grenade in my mouth. I don't know if... Riley poked her head out and said, "Hi there." 3, 2, 1. I opened the door all the way. Riley sidled up next to me, stuck out her hand, and said, "I'm Riley." Kaboom. Erica threw a shifty look my way, then took Riley's hand and shook it. "Sorry, I'm Erica." A long silence ensued. I mentally dug the large piece of shrapnel from my throat and said, "Cold today?" Riley and Erica glanced at each other, then looked back at me. They both nodded. I looked up, then said poignantly, "Might rain later." They both kept quiet. "Just saying, it might." Erica did a half turn and said, "I'm gonna take off. Good to see you, Thomas." She turned to Riley, gave a little head bob, and said, "Nice to meet you." Riley nodded at her and said, "Actually, I have to get going anyhow." She gave me a peck on the cheek, flashed a smile at Erica, then walked briskly to her car and drove off. Erica and I both watched as her green Jeep pulled onto the street. Erica looked at me and said, "She seems nice." She actually said this to the invisible person standing to my left. "She's my favorite cousin." Erica narrowed her eyes. I'm not sure she bought the cousin bit, and I'm not exactly sure why I was selling it. "Do you sleep with all your cousins?" "Just first cousins." She didn't seem to know how to take this. Anyhow, it was chilly outside, and I said, "So do you still want to come in?" I didn't wait for a response. I walked inside, leaving the door open behind me. I made my way into the kitchen and grabbed a box of waffles from the freezer. As I popped 4 waffles into the toaster, I heard the front door close. I waited for footsteps, but heard none. She was gone. I took a deep breath. How could I have handled this encounter with Erica differently? And why did I care? The last thing I wanted, needed, was to fall head over heels for another woman. I shook my head. I wonder if I could take legal action against Alex for screwing me up so badly. The waffles popped up. 2 were perfect and 2 were barely cooked. I took out the cooked ones and transferred the uncooked ones to the working slots, then let out a scream. A long one that had almost nothing to do with uncooked waffles. "Are you okay?" I turned to my left. Erica was standing in the doorway to the kitchen. I cleared my throat and said, "These waffles are taking forever to cook. It's very frustrating. I think it has something to do with the chocolate chips." "If you say so." The waffles popped up a second time, a perfect golden brown. I drenched the waffles in syrup. From the doorway, Erica said, "How do you feel about murder for hire?" It took me a moment to process her question. I was also processing a quadruple-decker bite and garbled, "Not against." She took a seat at the kitchen table and I joined her. I offered her a bite of waffles, but she respectfully declined. That she was here spoke volumes. I guess that their case, and by their, I mean Erica's, Ethan's, and the entire state of Washington's, had folded since I blew the whistle on the videotapes. I asked her about this. She said, "Gray met with the judge that next morning and showed him the tapes. It's obvious he was in his office when his yacht was being taken out. It's a third-party video surveillance, so there's no way the dates and times could have been tampered with. It's about as solid an alibi as you're going to get these days." I nodded. This didn't grant Adam Gray absolution from his wife's murder, but it did put a large dent in the prosecution's case. There was still the matter of his fingerprints on the gun. The gun itself and motive, which, the more I uncovered about the couple, only seemed to intensify. Erica finished. The judge dismissed the case on the spot. Ergo, she was asking me, a.k.a. the grand poobah of cunning and wizardry, to do some information gathering. For the first time, I wondered if she was here of her own accord, or if she'd been prodded by my pal Ethan. Or more logically, she was here to make certain that I was staying clear of the hen house, as promised. On this note, I asked, "And you are here because?" She moved backward a couple inches, as if I'd physically pushed her. She stammered, "Because I respect your opinion, and I wanted to know what your thoughts were on Adam Gray hiring someone to kill his wife. I thought you wanted me to keep my nose out of this."
"I do, but I pretty much accepted the fact that you aren't going to."
"Acceptance is the first step to recovery. Speaking of recovery, I was having what my psychiatrist referred to as trust issues. As in, I didn't trust people who weren't named Thomas. I didn't even trust all of these, especially that Bjorn guy." After a few awkward seconds, I said, "Well, I'd have to say the odds are slim Adam Gray would outsource his dirty work." She nodded. "I mean, this guy refuses to send a paralegal to research any minute detail he may need for a case. He's hands-on from start to finish. If Gray killed his wife, it would have been done perfectly. And you and I wouldn't be here right now because Ellen's body never would have been found and Adam would smell of roses. Seriously, this guy has an unhealthy relationship with order that hovers around OCD. Now, I'm not saying he's Howard Hughes, but he isn't far off. The only thing Adam Gray is guilty of is being an irrational neat freak, an awful husband, a negligent father, and a prick. Somebody wanted him to go to jail for his wife's murder. You find whoever had it out for the two of them, Ellen and Adam, and you found your murderer."
"Makes sense," she said dryly. She stood, "Well, I'd better be going."
I walked her to the door and had my second awkward foyer moment of the day. My record is 3. Erica stuck her hands in her pockets and glanced up at me. I had an overwhelming urge to grab her face and kiss her softly, almost as if something was bubbling inside of me and the only way to release it was to press my lips flush with hers. I'd never felt the bubbles with Riley. In fact, I'm not sure I'd felt the bubbles with Alex, at least not to this level. But I have a rule that I don't kiss 2 different women in the same 24-hour time period. I'm a class act like that. I patted her on the shoulder and said, "Thanks for stopping by." I'm quite certain these were not the parting words Erica was seeking. She did sort of a half smile and said, "Do me a favor and tell Riley, is it? That I'm sorry if I was rude earlier. I'm sure she's wonderful." "I'll be sure to do that." She added, "I mean, she is your favorite cousin." We both gave a forced laugh. She opened the door and started down the drive. She gave a little wave as she headed in the direction of her car. I almost called to her. I almost ran to her. I almost turned her around and kissed her, the kiss I had played over in my head since the day I laid eyes on her. Almost. Chapter 33. For some reason, they celebrated New Year's Eve on the 30th. Seriously. It was like they operated on some different calendar altogether. They probably celebrated Easter the 6th Sunday after the first Joseph died and Labor Day 2 weeks after the first hip broke. Harold was decked out in his Sunday best. He looked sharp. Dead, but sharp. I could describe my wardrobe selection in one word. Camel hair. I looked ridiculous, so needless to say, I fit in perfectly. We retired to the cafeteria, which had been decorated a la Millennium Party, and I felt like I was in my 7th-grade gymnasium. A table near the door was strewn with cheap top hats, plastic tiaras, noisemakers, and kazoos. I visualized all these old-timers blowing on kazoos at midnight. I hoped they had a couple defibrillators handy. Dinner was prime rib, potatoes, and cornbread. Most of the old-timers had a glass of wine. Harold had his, plus mine, and his Titleist-sized eyeballs had glassed over by the time we did a champagne toast. A couple dustbusters stood, or attempted to at any rate, and gave toasts. Mostly they toasted to still being alive, to loved ones that had already moved on, that we lived in such a great country. One lady toasted to cats, but more or less their toasts put life in perspective, and I was pretty choked up by the end. They did a mock countdown at 7 p.m., and the party raged until 7:13. Harold and I were the last to leave. Sitting just outside the cafeteria was a piano, and Harold stopped to rest. We generally stopped every 100 yards, so naturally I thought nothing of it. He sat on the small bench and took deep inhales on the oxygen tank. It might have been the wine, or the champagne, or the fact he was up an hour past his bedtime, but he looked especially old. Old and tired. He reminded me of one of those old trucks you see parked on the side of people's houses. Rusted, dented, weathered. What's left more spare parts than originals. But every time you turn the key, it would start. It would cough and sputter. It would choke and wane, almost as if it was on its hands and knees begging not to start. But eventually it would always turn over. The old truck swiveled and faced the piano. Harold stretched out his fingers and laid them gently on the keys. I wasn't sure if his fingers were hovering over the thin white keys, or if they lacked the weight, and he the strength to elicit sound. And then suddenly his fingers became music. The notes were deep and long, hanging in the air above the piano like London fog. I watched, mesmerized really, as Harold played snippets, small, delicate pieces of songs long forgotten. His eyes were closed, his head swaying from side to side. I wondered where Harold was, and what year it was, and who he was with. Somehow I knew. Harold stopped playing. He laid his hands by his sides, opened his large eyes, and said, "I walked past the King House every day for a year." For the first month, Harold walked past the King Place too, sometimes 3 times a day. After a 12- to 15-hour day in the field, he would walk the 7 miles to the King Mansion. Sometimes he would walk up the stone path and bang on the door a couple times, but mostly he would just toss rocks into the thin lake. The long days in the sun gave him plenty of time to ponder what had happened. Had she fallen out of love with him? Had he said or written something horrible that he didn't know about? How could someone say the things she said, say the things she felt, then just up and disappear? These questions ate at him as the hours crept by. On more than one occasion, Harold found himself huddled between the stalks of corn, legs curled up to his chest, tears dribbling down his cheeks. His life had been nearly perfect. He couldn't have asked for anything more. And then just like that, just like Thad's final breaths, it was all gone. Harold decided Elizabeth's father had to be at fault. He visualized the skinny man dragging Elizabeth from the house, kicking and screaming, her yelling at him how much she loved Harold, that she had to be with him, that he was coming for her, that she wasn't whole without him. Harold hated the man, a hate he didn't think he was capable of, a hate that during the throes of war he would have thought utterly impossible. He would think about Mr. King, and he would think about his own father. When Harold had walked through the door the night he'd returned, he'd tried to be strong. After all, he was a soldier. But when he'd seen his mother and his sisters, his facade had broken. His mother and sisters cried with him. As for his father, he didn't say a word, simply stuck out his hand and Harold shook it. His father might not be the smartest man, but he was a good man, and he worked hard. His father was nothing like Elizabeth's father. He'd started back in the fields the very next day. It was a large planting, and Harold kept busy. The days slowly turned into weeks, and the weeks into months. Harold had asked around, local merchants, other farmers, even his father, and no one knew where the Kings went, just that they were gone. His father was especially elated. If a year went by and no one heard from the Kings, the land would become his, and it did. It was late August of the following year. They were in the middle of the second harvest, and Harold's father even thought they might squeak out a third if the weather stayed the way it had been. Harold had just finished up a 12-hour day in the field. His back felt as though it might never again be straight. His arms, as if they were destined to stay at his sides for the rest of eternity. His feet, as if there was a nail driven through each heel. He overheard his mother tell his father that while coming back from town, she'd seen a bunch of cars at the King Place. Harold didn't waste a moment. He jumped off the rocking chair and started running, barefoot. His three sisters called after him, asking what in the devil had gotten in old Harold, but he didn't hear them. His Elizabeth had returned. He knew she would come back. They'd probably been on vacation. Maybe they'd gone to California or Florida, or even overseas. But it didn't matter where they'd been or why. They were back. His Elizabeth was back. Harold's feet pounded against the gravel for 7 miles, but he didn't feel a single solitary step. As he closed in on the house, he could see 4 cars parked in the drive. The cars were larger, newer, shinier. Harold ran up the drive. It never occurred to him what he looked like or what he was wearing. Harold never stopped to think what it would look like when a boy ran up to the house in overalls, no undershirt, covered in 2 days' worth of sweat and grime, barefoot, feet calloused and spurting blood. No, Harold was too preoccupied at the image of twirling his precious Elizabeth in his arms and telling her he would never let her go, that he would die before he let her go. As Harold neared the front door, a black man removed a large box from one of the cars. The man dropped the box and blocked Harold's path to the front door. He said slowly, with almost an air of superiority,
"This is private property, young lad." Harold asked to see his Elizabeth.
The black man shook his head and told him that no one named Elizabeth lived there. The family that moved into the King estate was the Grangers. They'd bought the property from the Kings. Harold could feel his heart, which just minutes earlier he was sure would leap right out of his chest, fall into his stomach. He doubled over and vomited. The black man told him to run along, giving him a slight push in the direction of the road, and began kicking dirt on Harold's mess. Harold wiped his mouth and turned on his heel. His head lowered, he slowly made his way down the dirt road. He could hardly lift his raw, bloody feet, more of a scraping than walking. When he was halfway down the long drive, the black man yelled at him. Harold turned. The man's outline was hazy through his stream of tears. From what he could tell, the man was no longer angry. Then the man said one word that would forever change Harold's life.
"Seattle?" He smiled.
"Seattle." I had a cramp in my right cheek from smiling. And let me guess, you moved to Seattle. I hopped on a train the next day.
It was 1947.
Harold had some money saved up from his days in the army, plus his father now owned the land and had given him some money on his departure. Harold found a small apartment in the city. He'd been in big cities before. He'd had to make train transfers in both Chicago and Pittsburgh, and he'd seen the ruins of major cities in Europe, but this was the first time he'd been part of a city. There were so many people. People in cars, people on bikes, people walking about. How was he ever supposed to find his dear, sweet Elizabeth with so many people around? He tried the phone books, but there were quite a few Kings, and the hours he spent on the phone were wasted hours. He spent a month searching for her, walking around the city day and night. After 5 weeks, Harold was beginning to run out of money. He saw an ad in one of the papers for airplane builders. Harold was skilled with his hands, and he had a good understanding of airplanes from time in the army. He started 3 days later. The hours were long and hard, but nothing could compare to a 16-hour day in the field. As the days passed, Harold found himself thinking of Elizabeth less and less. It was slowly dawning on him that it wasn't meant to be. Walking around one evening, Harold stumbled across a movie theater. In all of his 23 years, he'd never seen a cinema. He was quickly addicted. The Lady of Shanghai, The Bicycle Thief, Unfaithfully Yours, Letter from an Unknown Woman, Moonrise, Force of Evil. Harold saw them all. His favorite was Fort Chief with John Wayne. In December of his first year in Seattle, he'd been grocery shopping. He hadn't been paying attention and bumped into a young woman. She'd called him a doofus. He'd never been called a doofus before and found himself laughing uncontrollably. The woman quickly apologized for the remark. They had dinner 2 nights later. Harold and Gwen didn't spend a day apart for the next 6 months. He had a good job. He'd bought a car, a brand new Chevy. He had a great girl. Life was good. Harold, along with nearly everyone else, had been waiting impatiently for the next John Wayne film. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon opened on a rainy night in February of 1948. It was the best movie he'd ever seen. Harold remarked to Gwen as they were leaving the bustling theater. There was something about that John Wayne, something magnetic. You couldn't take your eyes off him. Gwen held his arm and whispered softly in his ear, "He's almost as handsome as you." But Harold was a million miles away, and if it weren't for the dark corridor, Gwen would have seen that Harold was white as a ghost. She did notice his body had gone stiff and asked, "What's wrong?" Harold shook his head and continued to stare at the raven-haired woman 10 feet in front of him. She was with a group of 6 or 7 other girls. All their hair was done up the same, curled up and under, and they were giggling as they moved through the doors and into the drizzle. Harold didn't know how he knew, but he did. Without a word, he unhooked his arm and pushed through the crowd. Gwen asked where he was going, but he didn't hear her. He pushed into the drizzle, spotting the group of ladies starting up a side street. He followed behind them. The group, huddled beneath a collection of umbrellas, stopped. One of the girl's shoes had fallen off. It was the girl Harold hadn't taken his eyes off for the past 60 seconds. She knelt down, grabbed her shoe, and hopped around trying to put it back on her foot. And suddenly she stopped, the shoe dangling from her hand, her right foot hanging in the air. She was staring directly at Harold. One of the girls in the group said, "What's wrong? Elizabeth, what's wrong?" It was her. Harold ducked behind a post. Why hadn't he run to her? Why hadn't he picked her up and twirled her? What would John Wayne have done? Would John Wayne have hid behind a street lamp until she left? Harold smacked his head backwards against the post, then peeked out. The girls were getting into a car. His Elizabeth was the last to get in. She gave one final look in his direction before getting in the car. Harold watched as the car sped away. I yelled, "You didn't go talk to her?" Harold shook his head. "I couldn't." "You big weenie," he smiled. "So what did you do?"
"I ran to my car and followed them."
"You followed them?"
"Sure did. Hell Cove Academy, a private women's college."
"What happened to Gwen?" He had a piano key down with his finger, its soothing sound rumbling through the small room, and said,
"I never saw Gwen again."
I laughed so hard my knees buckled. Luckily, I was sitting down. Harold turned to me and asked,
"You like polka?"
Chapter 34. I took a long run in the rain. Back at the house, I grabbed a glass of water, gulped it down, then went back for a second. Days earlier, I'd noticed a phone jack underneath the cabinets just to the right of the faucet, and I'd taken the liberty of transplanting Lacey's pink phone. Then, while rummaging around in the basement, I'd stumbled across an antique answering machine. I'd hooked this up to the phone. A large button at the bottom right corner of the machine was blinking red. I hit the button, then went back to the faucet for a third glass of water. The mechanical voice said, "December 31st, 2:36 p.m. A moment later, Lacey's voice came on.
"You got an answering machine, yay! So I haven't talked to you since Christmas. Hope you enjoyed the game, saw that they won. Anyhow, I'm headed out. We're hosting a party at the gallery. Starts in about half an hour. Just wanted to wish you a happy new year. No need to call me back. Talk to you next year."
I smiled at the sound of her voice. The answering machine wasn't done. December 31st, 2:47 p.m.
"Hi, Thomas, it's Riley."
I didn't recall giving Riley my telephone number, but then again, she did do a couple things to me for which I would have given up Anne Frank's hiding spot.
"She's in the attic. Don't stop. Anyhow, I thought if you weren't busy this evening, you might want to join me for some New Year's festivities. I'll cook us dinner. We could drink some wine. Nothing too glamorous. I know this is sort of last minute, and if you already have plans, then no worries. Talk to you later. Go Seahawks."
I could think of worse ways to ring in the new year. I'd planned on ordering pizza, drinking a six-pack, and maybe doing a backflip off the balcony. A third message began to play. 31st, 3:12 p.m.
"Hey, Mr. Prescott."
It was Erica.
"If you aren't doing anything tonight, a bunch of us are going over to this bar over on 3rd, called Markey's."
I hit pause. I knew Markey's. It was an Irish pub with an identity crisis on Cherry Street. It had changed hands so many times all that was left of its original heritage was a Guinness mirror and a couple shamrock urinal cakes. Of course, this was 8 years ago. I remembered the place usually having a decent crowd, and I'd even spent a couple New Year's Eves there. I hit play.
"It should be fun, anyhow, if you're looking for something to do tonight. That's an option. See ya."
Interesting. I wondered if Erica was just being polite, or she was trying to secure a midnight kiss. I'd heard of women who lined up 3 or 4 backup plans just in case one didn't work out. No woman wanted to be the girl stuck kissing her brother, or her friend, or worse yet, no one at all. I blew out a long breath and made for the refrigerator. The mechanical voice came on one last time and I turned around. Talk about Mr. Popularity. The message played, 4:45 p.m. I looked at the clock above the stove, 5:23 p.m. Whoever it was called right around the time I hit mile 3 of my jog. A voice came on. This time it was a man's.
Thomas, sorry I missed you.
It was Ethan.
Hey, I never got a chance to thank you for that little piece of detective work you did with the surveillance tapes.
Top of the line, Thomas, top of the line.
Although I briefly remember telling you that I didn't want you coming near this case.
Do you remember that conversation, Thomas? Do you?
It went a little something like this. You better watch your ass, Prescott, or I'm going to make sure someone at county watches it for you.
Ring a bell?
I hit pause. I remember him saying this. I also remember wanting to rip out his larynx after he said it. I hit play.
I'm just calling to make sure that in the new year you don't do anything stupid. I've got the go-ahead from the boys upstairs to arrest you for just about anything. You fart and I smell it and you're finished, you piece of shit. I told you to leave as quickly as you came. You should have listened to me. Oh, and one last thing, you prick. Stay away from Erica. You come near her, I'm not going to arrest you. I'm going to shoot you. Hey, Happy New Year, pal.
I wanted to call Ethan and tell him that the last time he threatened me, he ended up with a broken nose, but then I'd be buying into his macho bullshit. I made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and contemplated my 4 phone messages. Then I took a well-deserved nap. Chapter 35. Riley's cabin was tucked back deep in the Cascade, 7 winding roads past the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Building. It was made of logs and was square. I think I'd built the prototype with Lincoln logs when I was 7. I parked behind Riley's Jeep, grabbed the bottle of wine off the passenger seat and strode to the door. I hadn't known exactly how to dress for the occasion, so I'd gone with a sweater, and a bad one at that. It was between my dad's holiday sweater collection, of which 3 lit up and 1 sang, and his Cosby collection. I'd chosen one from the latter, and my sweater looked like it was sewn by a blind lady with an affinity for triangles. I knocked on the door, and Riley pulled it inward. She looked me up and down and said, "Nice sweater." I brushed at it and said, "Dr. Huxtable, at your service." I would have gone directly into my Cosby pudding pop bit, but I was a tad rusty. Riley got a giggle out of this and said, "Did you find the place okay?" This question really annoys me, and I was tempted to say, if I didn't, I probably wouldn't be here. But Riley wasn't wearing much, and I put my wise-ass remarks on screensaver. I said I found the place just fine. For the record, Riley was wearing an apron. That's it. The apron was pink and said in wide lettering, "No bitchin' in my kitchen." I told her I liked her apron. She lifted the bottom of its skirt and twirled. I nearly dropped the bottle of wine, not to mention poking a hole through my favorite sweater. I followed her inside and set the brown bag holding the wine on the counter. 2 fish were laid out on a white cutting board. The scales were still oily and the eyes glassy. Come to think of it, they looked a lot like those stupid fish people hang on their walls that sing, "Take Me to the River." I commented, "Nice looking fish." "Bass. Billy Bass." She said, "Caught them this morning." "Give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man a fish, he eats every day." "Right. Which are you?" "I eat waffles." She laughed. Then she opened the refrigerator, bent down, gulp, and handed me a Miller Lite. I took it from her. We clinked beer necks and both took a drink. Riley scooted me out of the kitchen, demanding that I take a look around while she filleted Billy and Bonnie Bass. She took out a large knife and said, "Beat it." She was really living up to that apron. So I walked the small cabin, and I had that stupid song in my head, which is quite possibly worse than an arrow. "Take me to the river. Throw me in the water. Stick a gun in my mouth. Blow my brains out." The cabin was small. 1 bedroom, small bath, living room, small dining room. I walked into the small bedroom and pushed my hand down on the bed. It wasn't a Sleep Number by Select Comfort, but it would do. There was a small window, and I peeked out at an angle. It was a darkness only known to the deep mountains. I thought I saw a sputter of light in the distance and pushed my face against the cold glass. It had been just the faintest of glows, like the flickering of a lighter. I watched for another minute but didn't see the anomaly again. I was a bit on edge. I thought I'd seen a car following me on the highway. I'd been expecting Ethan to put a tail on me at some point, but I didn't figure too many guys would be volunteering for overtime on New Year's Eve. Anyhow, by the time I made it full circle, The bottle of wine was open and breathing. I couldn't help but notice Riley had taken the liberty of pouring herself a small glass. I said, "Thanks for waiting. I'm not really the patient type." I, of course, had learned this firsthand. She slid two large, seasoned fish fillets into a pan, and they began sizzling. She looked up at me and said, "They take about 6 minutes a side."
6 minutes, huh?
Funny, that was my average. She picked up her glass and chugged the remaining inch. Then she undid her apron and let it drop to the floor. It was the couch the first time. Then she went to flip the fish. Then it was the kitchen floor. After we'd eaten, Riley said she wanted to drink wine and watch me do the dishes. Kinky, I know. At 11:30, we cuddled up on the couch and watched Dick Clark's New Year's Rocking Eve, which had actually been over for nearly 3 hours, and no doubt Dick Clark was already under the covers, or in his hyperbolic chamber, or frozen, or hanging upside down in his cave. We were under a blanket, Riley lying backward against me. I rubbed her firm belly with my right hand. She scratched my arm. I was in lust again. At 11:59, Riley jumped up, ran to the kitchen, and emerged a second later with a bottle of bubbly. They released the ball, and it slowly started to move down the pole. The crowd started chanting, and Riley began counting down with them. At 6 seconds, she pinched my leg, and in my best Hans impression, I said, "Fünf, vier, drei, zwei, eins, Happy New Year!" After she shook her head in utter dismay, we kissed. And at that moment, in those first few moments of the new year, Riley Peterson was my only thought. She stuck her arm through mine, and we both chugged our glasses of champagne. Then we kissed some more. Then we rang in the new year. Riley didn't have a kazoo, so we improvised. Chapter 36. I opened my eyes and craned my head off the sofa. I wasn't sure who would be knocking at my door at 9 in the morning, the first day of the year, and I was in no mood to find out. The knocking subsided, and I laid my head back down and closed my eyes. I'd left Riley's at sometime around 3:30 a.m., considerably tuckered out, and I was yet to get my 8 hours of required shut-eye. Riley had to get up early, not my early, but her early, and I was happy for the excuse to sleep on my own couch. The knocking started back in, and I rolled off the sofa and walked to the door. I looked through the peephole. Whoever was out there was standing just inches from the lens, and I couldn't decipher much, but it did appear to be more than one person. Whoever they were persona non grata on my doorstep. I smoothed out the sweater, went to unlock the door, but it was already unlocked, and pulled it open. I stared at Erica and Ethan through half-open eyes. I looked from one to the other, licked my lips, yawned, took a deep breath, yawned again, slammed the door and locked it, walked back to the couch and flopped back onto it. This was about the time the knocking started back up. It lasted 5 minutes. After 10, I decided they weren't going anywhere. Maybe Ethan had come to congratulate me in person on my outstanding detective work. Then again, maybe he'd bought me some huge sunglasses, a bomber jacket, and a plane ticket to South Korea. I rolled off the couch and made the check to the door a second time. As I pulled it open, I said to Ethan, whose hand was still in a fist and in the upright position, "If you stop banging your hand against the door, it will stop making that annoying knocking sound." He sneered at me and took a step back. Erica stepped forward and said, "We need to talk to you for a few minutes, if that's okay." Ethan threw her a strained glance. I don't think he appreciated her soft-spoken manner or the fact she was asking my permission. But it was obvious from their body language that they had planned on Erica leading the attack, whatever that might be. I could think of only a handful of reasons that would put Ethan Cates and Erica Frost on my doorstep 9 hours into the new year. One, I was being arrested. For what? Well, there was the breaking and entering at Adam Gray's place, but I found it hard to believe he would press charges after what I'd done for him. Then you add my overall involvement in the case, which in some circles they might call hampering an investigation. But I hadn't done much hampering in the last couple days. In fact, since I'd taken my trip to the North Cascades, I hadn't done much hampering at all. But Ethan had it in for me. And we all know when someone has it in for you, all the rules are thrown out the window. Which led to the only other thing I could think of. There had been a break in the Ellen Gray case, and Ethan and Erica were here to ask my advice. This option was slightly less believable than Scientology, So in a nutshell, I had not the slightest clue. Not an inkling why an asshole, Erica, and two cops standing off in the distance were all staring at me like I had deviled egg all over my face. I raised my eyebrows and said, "And what exactly do you need to talk to me about? We just have a couple questions." The quicker I answered their questions, the quicker I could get back to sleep. I said, "Fire away." Ethan said, "Where were you last?" Erica held up her hand, and he stopped mid-sentence. She nearly smiled and said, "So, how did you spend your New Year's Eve?" I wasn't sure I wanted to divulge to Erica that I spent the majority of my night playing hide the pickle with Park Ranger Peterson. But I'd also asked variations of this question enough times to know that if you aren't going to tell the truth, you need to say something that is nearly impossible to verify. So I said, "I didn't do much, didn't leave the house, in bed by one." Ethan said in a matter-of-fact tone, "Does the name Riley Peterson mean anything to you?" I took a step back. I gave a slight nod and said, "Rings a bell, why?" I noticed Erica staring at her feet in my peripheral. I also noticed for the first time that Ethan was holding a manila envelope in his right hand. He opened the envelope and extracted a glossy photo. He held out the photo and said, "She was found early this morning." The words "was" and "found" rattled around my brain. I snapped the photo from Ethan's fingers and glanced down at it. Riley lay on her stomach on her kitchen linoleum. Blood pooled around her naked body. My heart was caught in my throat. I couldn't believe Riley was dead. I'd seen her, all of her, every inch just hours earlier. Now she was just a cold shell, lying in a pool of her own blood. I said through clenched teeth, "Who found her?" Erica was still looking down and spoke quietly. "Some guy she works with. When she didn't show up for work and didn't answer his calls, he drove to her cabin." "What time?" "A couple hours ago." "What time?" 7:23 a.m. Ethan couldn't stand it. "If you don't mind, we'll ask the questions." I wanted to tell him to go fuck himself, but held it in. After a slight pause, he asked, "Were you with the victim last night? Would you be here if I weren't?" "No." Evidently, Ethan had put a tail on me. "You had me followed, you piece of shit." "First off, if I wanted to put a tail on you, it would be well within my jurisdiction, but no, I didn't." If Ethan hadn't had me followed, then who had been following me? And more importantly, how did they know how I rang in the new year? Ethan sensed my thought process and said, "We found a receipt for a bottle of wine in the trash. You used your MasterCard." "Right." I looked at Erica and said, "Isn't this a little out of your guy's jurisdiction?" Ethan said, "I pulled some strings." I bet he did. I bet once he heard my name, he called in every marker he had out there. But then again, some of these smaller counties don't even have a homicide detective on the payroll and wouldn't hesitate to pass the buck. Ethan broke my musings. "Why did you lie about being with the victim?" "Because it's none of your business how or with who I spend my New Year's." And I was trying to be somewhat of a gentleman in front of Erica Frost. "This is true. But when a woman ends up dead and you were the last one to see her alive, then it becomes my business." Touché, but since I didn't kill her, I highly doubted I was the last one to see her alive. Erica asked, "You mind telling us about your night?" Ethan gave Erica another harsh stare. He didn't like that her approach ended with question marks. He was right. You don't ask questions, you demand answers. I shook my head and said, "Not really." Ethan took a deep breath and said, "Account for your whereabouts from the minute you left the house last evening to when you returned home." "No thanks." "Then you wouldn't mind if we took a look inside." I took a step to the side and said, "Be my guest." He waved the cops forward and they strode past me. One of the cops snarled at me as he passed. I grabbed his arm and dug my fingers into his small biceps and said, "Be careful. I wouldn't want to have to break anything valuable of yours." He ripped his arm from my grasp, threw me a look, then ambled past me. That left Erica, Ethan, and me standing on the stoop and more or less twiddling our thumbs. You had Ethan, who hated my guts and had a good suspicion that I was a murderer. Then he had Erica, who was interested in Mr. Thomas Prescott, but was a bit circumspect now that he might have killed a woman. And then he had Thomas Prescott, who could give half a shit about the two people standing on his porch because a woman he cared about was dead. and she was never coming back. Anyhow, no words were said. After about 30 seconds, Ethan said to Erica, "I'd better get in there and make sure they aren't breaking any of Thomas's valuables." He walked past me. I wondered if it was coded in his DNA to be such an unconscionable prick. At present, Erica was checking her shoes for scuffs. She looked up and said, "I'm sorry." She didn't specify what exactly she was sorry for, but I assumed it was an all-inclusive sorry about Riley, sorry that we had to come here today, and sorry that it had to be like this. Or maybe it was a pre-sorry for what was still to come. My arrest, the sentence, and the prison anal raping. Then again, it could be a post-sorry, a sorry we ever met. Regardless, she was just doing her job. I gave a little nod. 15 minutes later, Ethan emerged. He made eye contact with Erica that said they hadn't found anything. I asked, "Did you stumble across my Game Boy?" Ethan ignored me. I asked, "Where are Tweedledee and Tweedledum?" He smiled and said, "Just tidying up a bit. They were probably taking a whiz on my ice trays and giving me an upper decker." 5 minutes later, the first of the officers walked out. He gave me an odd stare. 3 feet behind him was his buddy. He shook his head at me and smiled. In his right hand, shielded by his body, was a clear evidence bag. He walked up to Ethan and said defiantly, "We found this in the flamingo room." Ethan held up the baggie. In the evidence bag was a long, curved knife. I recognized it. It was the knife Riley had used to fillet the fish. 8 eyes trained on the knife, then moved to my chest. Oh, bugger. Chapter 37. Interrogation rooms have changed over the years. The concrete bunkers, one-way mirrors, bolted-down tables, garage lighting, and heat lamps were a thing of the past. Leave that stuff to the KGB. Nowadays, most everything was glass. Studies showed suspects were measurably more cooperative when they were on display. Today, however, this would not be the case. I rested my elbows on the thin, rectangular table and watched Ethan, Erica, and a handful of others confer through the tinted glass. This went on for over an hour. Different people would come and go. There would be a quick conference. Sometimes something would be passed from one person to another, and always a quick glance in my direction before leaving. 20 minutes later, Ethan pushed through the door. He feigned reading a document, then looked up. He looked almost surprised to see me, like he hadn't expected me to be in the room he'd locked me in. He asked, "How you doing?" "I'm super." He sat down, and I noticed for the first time since I had met him that he wasn't chewing gum. At that moment, he pulled a pack from his coat pocket, that stuff you push through the foil and pop to piece. He offered the pack to me, and I respectfully declined. "I've been off the stuff for 3 years now," I said. He didn't find this amusing. I almost told him to lighten up. I mean, he would have thought the guy was a suspect in a homicide investigation or something. He had a bunch of paperwork spread out in front of him, including the manila envelope containing the crime scene photos of Riley. This might be my only chance to view the pictures, and I asked, "You mind?" He shrugged and slid the envelope across the table. This would have been a later tactic on his behalf, make the suspect study the pictures. Sometimes the reality of the crime would hit home, and then the suspect would crack on the spot. I'd seen it happen before my very eyes. I'd even had one suspect look at the crime scene photos of an 11-year-old girl he murdered and smile with pride. I may have accidentally smashed his face into the picture. Accidents happen. I slid the envelope off the table and stared at it. I'd seen hundreds of these crime scene photographs, and it's never easy. If you know the person intimately, as I knew Riley, it was nearly impossible. Some people could flip that switch, turn off their emotions. Take Ethan, for example. He had looked at these pictures, and he hadn't seen Riley. He hadn't even seen a woman. He saw a case. He saw a picture of someone behind bars. He saw a picture of me, maybe with a needle in my arm. Or maybe he saw a picture of me tossing some big black guy's salad. Whatever he saw, he didn't see death. I'd never been able to flip that switch. I was emotionally involved in every case I ever worked. It separated me from them. It's why I was the best, or had been. I extracted a stack of 7 glossy photographs. The top photo was the one I'd already seen. I gave this a quick glance, then shuffled it to the back. The next was a close-up of Riley's head and neck. Her short brown hair fell over her face, but her left eye was visible, open about halfway. There was a dark gash in her neck, and dried blood was caked around the wound like dried lava. The blood pooled around her neck in about a foot radius, and the surface had just begun to harden into a blood pudding. I flipped to the next picture. It was the whole of the kitchen. Blood splatter covered the white linoleum, a couple of the cabinets, and half the white cutting board. I glanced at the remaining four pictures, slid them back in the envelope, and slid the envelope back across the table. Ethan said, "Admiring your work? Fuck you." He paused for a few moments, then said, "So tell me how it went down." "I told you, when I last saw Riley, she was very much alive." He nodded. He riffled through the papers, not looking at anything in particular, then glanced up. "Here's what we got. We can put you at the scene. You and no one else. So, you had the means. You lied to us about your alibi. That's never good. And we found the murder weapon hidden under your sister's bed." He shook his head. "Now, if you were me, would you arrest you?" Was this guy born in Pronounville? I asked, "If I were me, would you arrest I? You think this is funny?" "I certainly do not," and I didn't. After a long moment, I answered his question. "First, I'm not you. If I was, I would have done the world a favor, checked the organ donor box in the back of my license, and jumped in front of a greyhound years ago." Ethan's nostrils gave a slight flare, and I continued. "Second, yes, I would probably arrest me." He grinned. "But only if you were me." The grin faded. He'd had about enough of me. I'm better in doses. He stood up and said, "I'm going to go grab a drink. You want something?" I was parched and said, "A blue Powerade, the one with the sports top." There was a vending machine on the third floor that sold such things. At least there had been 8 years ago. He waved me off and said, "Nothing then, jerk." I watched through the glass as Ethan conversed quickly with Erica. I could make out the last words he said. "Are you up for this?" She nodded. Then she stared at me through the glass. Ethan gave me one last look. I mouthed, "Blue Powerade, sports top." He mouthed two unmistakable words before walking off. Erica had turned around, no doubt to take one last calming breath, then pushed through the doors. I didn't take my eyes off her as she pulled out a chair and sat. She raised the left side of her mouth and said, "How you doing?" I shook my head. This was going to be far more difficult than I had anticipated. Ethan had been a cinch. This tore at my heartstrings. She gave a quick smile, then her right hand shot forward a couple inches. She caught herself and drew it back. After a lengthy pause, she said, "So I've been talking to the DA. I knew where this was heading, and I began shaking my head. "Hear me out, please." Her voice was trembling. "I've been talking to the DA, and I think we can plead this down to man two. That's less than 15. Hell, these days you wouldn't do more than 6 or 7. I reached out and grabbed Erica's hand. I said slowly, "I didn't do it." It might have been my touch, or the fact that tears were starting to form in the creases of my eyes, but I saw it. Erica had walked through those doors under the presumption I was a killer. No longer. If Ethan hadn't entered then, I might have leaned over the table and kissed her. Ethan pulled up a chair and said, "Am I interrupting something?" I noticed he just happened to be holding a blue Powerade with a sports top. Erica shook her head. "Good." He flipped the top in the Powerade, threw me a wry smile, brought the bottle to his mouth and squeezed. Nothing came out. He raised his eyebrows, shook the bottle, and squeezed again. Again, nothing came out. I laughed. 3 shakes, 5 squeezes, and 30 seconds later, Ethan unscrewed the top and peeled off the safety seal under the cap. This took my mind off the fact I was being investigated for murder for a split second. That is until a woman in a lab coat pushed through the door and handed a printed document to Ethan. Ethan perused the document, then handed it to Erica. She gave it a quick glance before handing it back to Ethan. He shook his head and said, "Bad news, Thomas. Very bad news." "Aren't you supposed to ask if I want to hear the good news first?" "There is no good news." "That was bad news." He slid the document across the table. He said, "We were able to lift a set of fingerprints from the knife. Full thumb and partial right index." He paused and added, "Both are exact matches to your prints on file." I picked up the document. The document was 6 separate images.
There were images of both sides of the knife. The knife was about 8 inches long, slightly curved, like a quarter moon. Small amounts of dried blood speckled both sides. You could see the thumbprint on one side of the blade and the partial index on the opposite side. Then there were two blown-up images of the fingerprints, as well as two blow-ups of my prints that were on file. Both were positive matches. I slid the document back over the table and said calmly, "I did the dishes." He looked confused, and I repeated, "I did the dishes." "You expect me to believe that you left those prints while washing the dishes?"
"I don't give a shit what you believe. That's what happened."
"If you were washing the dishes, then it makes sense that you would have washed off your